little Bollywood to begin this next segment about India. For decades after independence, the economy of India hardly expanded at all, and outsiders insultingly invoked what they called the Hindu rate of growth to describe the country's seemingly permanent stagnation. But since the turn of the century, something's changed. The economy in India has boomed, in particular for a slice of Indian society. India now has levels of economic stratification that rival America's during its own Gilded Age, and this worries some people. India's on track to overtake China as the world's most populated country with a projected 1.5 billion people by 2025. In his new book, The Billionaire Raj, A Journey Through India's New Gilded Age, James Crabtree questions what kind of country it's becoming and whether its growth is sustainable. Hi, James.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Your book opens up, and the cover actually shows a particular building in Mumbai that is widely known as the world's most expensive residence. It's called Antilia, and I guess for you it embodies both the glamorous promise of India as well as its incredible class distinction. So tell us a little more about this home and its owner, if you could.
Yeah, so I moved to India in 2011. I was a foreign correspondent for a British newspaper. I came to the airport. I was picked up by a driver, which is what happens in India, and we drove down through Mumbai, which is the Indian financial capital. It's a bit like New York. It's thin, tall city, lots of skyscrapers on a peninsula. And you get down to roughly midtown, and then looming up in front of you is this building called Antilia. It's about 170 meters tall, and it belongs to a gentleman called Mukesh Ambani, who's the richest man in India. And it is a house for him and his wife and his three kids. And they call it the billion-dollar house. No one really knows how much it actually cost to build, but it is an extraordinary building. You know, it has all of the accoutrements of a luxurious hotel. It has hanging gardens. It has gyms and saunas. It has its own indoor football pitch in the sub-basement. It's rumored to have a snow room, which is a small room in which you can go in and sort of get flurries of snow in the heat of the Indian summer. And this was built about 10 years ago, and it has come to embody the extraordinary inequality that has come over India. It's probably the most lavish private home anywhere in the world. Mukesh Ambani is worth $40 billion, so that makes him the richest man, not just in India, but also in Asia. And this is in a city where roughly half of the residents still live in slums.
Not too far off from this home itself, right?
No, not right next door, but you know, within maybe half a kilometer, you could find a situation in which people are living, you know, fairly miserable lives, and that is true for an awful lot of people. Mumbai is the richest city in India, but still, half of the people there live in slums, and it's a country as a whole where the average person still earns sort of $1,600-$1,700 a year, and so to even get into the 1%, the top 1% in India, you only need about $38,000 a year. So it's not a rich country by any means, but at the very top, you have this new strata that is richer than almost anywhere in the world.
And so you have this, this rising number of billionaires, of which Mukesh Ambani happens to be maybe the most famous one.
Yeah, he's top dog, and he has been for quite a while, actually. But yes, in the mid-1990s, India had two billionaires. And now it has 120. And so you've had this huge explosion. And it's an extraordinary change over the course of a generation. So before 1991, before the reforms, this was a country where almost nobody had a telephone, where you had to, you had to wait in line if you wanted to buy almost anything. It was a socialist planned economy. A very inefficient, very little worked properly, as you said. The economy didn't grow very quickly, the Hindu rate of growth. Then after 1991, it liberalized and opened up to the world. But in particular, in the mid-2000s, that's when things really started taking off. And that's what I call the new era of the billionaire Raj, where you had huge inequality opening up at the very top. You had big problems with corruption in particular, mega corruption scandals. And that has kind of come to define the politics and business of India over the last 10 years.
This is extraordinary statistic that you pull out, that during the stock market boom of 2008, the wealth of just the billionaires in India alone amounted to 22% of the country's GDP.
Yeah.
Is there any other country that compares this?
Yeah, Russia, and often sometimes Mexico. But I mean, that was an unusual. That was a high point. It's not quite that high anymore. It's gone down a little bit. But nonetheless, India, as a proportion of, if you measure billionaire wealth against GDP, India is one of the highest in the world. It also, it's still a relatively poor country. So it has fewer billionaires than China now. But China is much richer at roughly the same stage of development. So China in 2006 or so had the same size of GDP as India does today. Today, India has 120 billionaires. In 2006, China had 10. So India is creating wealth at the very top. Might not be quite as bad as Russia, but you know, it's right up there with the biggest wealth creations amongst the hyper wealthy of any country in history. And that's not really where you want to be as a developing country. I mean, having lots of wealth, having lots of rich people is actually a pretty good thing. You know, you want to have wealth creation, you want to have businesses that are making money. But countries that are very, very, very unequal, like Brazil, like South Africa, a little bit like America to some degree, it comes with problems. And so ideally, you want to be a little less unequal than India is now.
And so this is, I guess, you point out that this is a debate or, I guess, changing ways of looking at wealth, whether absolute terms of poverty matter more or whether inequality matters more. Where do you come out in that debate?
It's a little bit of both, right? I mean, India has actually had a very successful record of poverty reduction. So it wasn't that long ago when you were talking hundreds of millions, maybe 500 million people in India living in abject poverty, however you measure it, less than $2 a day. That's come down a lot. I mean, India, it does not get the credit it deserves for the reduction in absolute poverty, but still, you know, that's not a great measure. I mean, even if you're lifting people above $2 a day, they're not living terrific lives. Nonetheless, it's important to have that happen. But if you have very high inequality, there are lots of problems that come with that. It actually makes your economy less stable, the research suggests. It makes it harder to introduce economic reforms if people feel that, you know, the rich are going to get all the benefits. So there are, if you look at the most successful developing economies, the East Asian tigers, countries like South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, the ones that have gone from being very poor to being middle income to being rich, none of them have done it by being as unequal as India is. Actually, they did it in quite an inclusive way. They had hospitals and schools for the poor. They had sort of factory jobs for people coming off farms. And the rich had to pay their taxes and sort of play by the rules to some degree.
And you're talking about which places now?
These are the East Asian countries that have made a success of their development. And so, although, you know, you don't want to go back to the old world of socialism, of leveling down, that was a disaster for India. You know, from my point of view, I used to work for the Financial Times, which is a business newspaper. I have no problem with markets and sort of people making money honestly. There are billionaires in India in the software sector, in pharmaceuticals, in areas like that, that have, you know, made huge fortunes and done it pretty basically honestly. And that's great. Part of the problem is that quite a lot of the people who made their money in India didn't do it honestly. They did it through crony capitalism. And even then, you want to have a situation in which the distance between the top and the bottom is not totally unbridgeable. And in India, part of the problem is everyone knows India is a very unequal country. You have the caste system, you have divisions of language and region. It's a very diverse place. But almost because we view it as an unequal place, we haven't noticed how spectacularly more unequal it has become financially over the last 10 or 20 years.
Speaking to the author of The Billionaire Raj, A Journey Through India's New Gilded Age, it's James Crabtree, former journalist with the Financial Times, talking about what kind of country India is becoming and its spectacular levels of class distinctions. So crony capitalism, you talk about that as being sort of at the heart of the problem in India. Tell me what that is and how it's, I guess, expressed in India.
I mean, crony capitalism, if you're an academic, it means collusion between the political and the business elite. So the reason why I call the book India's New Gilded Age is I'm remembering America's Gilded Age after the Civil War, running between, you know, the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, where there was a huge amount of crony capitalism. Here in New York, you had Tammany Hall, you had billionaires, well, not billionaires, but the sort of functional equivalent, people like Cornelius Vanderbilt and Jay Gould, the robber barons. Mm-hmm. And how did the robber barons get rich? Well, partly they got rich by taking huge amounts of risk, but also they tended to have the politicians in their pocket. And so they got, you know, the right regulations, they got land when they needed it. And that's basically what's happened in India as well. You have businessmen who are effectively robber barons of a sort. And some of them are very good businessmen. It's very hard to make an honest living in India. It's a tricky place to do business. And so some of them are pretty good at what they do, but they're also very good at manipulating the government. And so 10 years ago, you started getting these mega corruption scandals, multi-billion dollar scams in which people were being gifted coal mining licenses, telecom spectrum, that sort of thing. And so the politics of crony capitalism and the fact that ordinary people, particularly the middle class, are very angry about how much corruption there is one of the big things that India has to manage.
Let's talk again about Mukesh Ambani. He is this person who is somewhat, I guess, opaque. He's relatively removed from society. He sort of lives in this this lavish, incredible home, Antilia. Have you actually been to Antilia?
I have not, no.
A lot of people do, I guess. They go to these parties that are held in the ground floor in this incredible grand ballroom of sorts that you... So in some ways, he's removed, and yet he still sort of helps perpetuate or host the party culture of the city, doesn't he?
I mean, it's the thing that most reminds me of is a sort of... So if you go to Istanbul and you go to the Sultan's Palace, then you have a space that is at once private and public. There's a little sort of castle inside a castle, and it's a bit like that in Antilia. They have, they host parties in which you have Bollywood celebrities and cricketers. They host weddings for, their family, their distant relatives. They'll throw these big parties. And, all of Mumbai high society is invited. And, of course, you'd never turn down an invite to go to a party at Mukesh Ambani's house because they're lavish. They will reorder. It's like going to the best hotel in town and then some, and each time it will be different. They'll reorganize the whole of the ballroom space that they have, which is as large as you'd find in a 5-star hotel. And so, yeah, it's a bit like going to the court of a monarch.
And so when you have this kind of buy-in from the a significant section of the, I guess, the intellectual and creative class, is that sort of a way of, I guess, just making yourself popular? Is he a popular guy in India despite this really ostentatious display of wealth?
Well, he himself, actually, it's a sort of curiosity because he himself is not that blingy. There are some Indian billionaires who are terrifically outspoken. One of the most famous was a guy called Vijay Mallya, who ran the airline Kingfisher and Kingfisher Beer, which some of your listeners might have heard of. And he was incredibly flamboyant. He had a ponytail. He wore diamond earrings. He went out drinking all the time. And Mukesh Ambani, he wears a plain cotton shirt. He's actually supposed to be quite modest in his habits. I only met him a couple of times in passing, but he's fairly quiet. He's quite shy. And yet he still built this incredibly ostentatious house, which everyone in Mumbai can see. So as a figure, he divides opinion, I think. Some people admire him for what he did. Although he inherited his business from his dad, their family are not old money. His dad was a first-generation...
Self-starter.
His dad was a first-generation entrepreneur who... kind of broke the rules a bit, but actually, was a very successful entrepreneur. A lot of people admire him, but he also is very controversial. A lot of people see him as a kind of emblem of many of the things that are bad in India.
And so Mukesh Ambani, how does he fit into this larger culture of crony capitalism?
Ah, well, you've got to be a bit careful here, don't you? You've got to watch your step. They're a litigious lot. So he, in the last election in 2014, when the current Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, won a landslide election on an anti-corruption platform, Mukesh Ambani figured very prominently in that election. So anti-corruption campaigners accused him of being a kind of emblem of a certain sort of crony capitalism. Now, he, of course, would deny this and say that he has nothing to do with this. And that tends to be where you get to. There hasn't been a huge scandal around his businesses, but he does get involved in lots of legal fights. So anti-corruption campaigners claim that he bends the rules and then he denies it.
You talked about Vijay Mallya, who you characterize him as having this sort of a mullet. It's business up front and party in the back, as you described his hairdo. He's now in exile, so in a sense, he is one of the, I guess, the victims. Well, I don't know if victim is the right word, but he certainly has felt the receiving end of the media and the popular backlash, and now he lives in exile in England, doesn't he?
Yeah, there's a sort of series of tycoons who leave India under a cloud and go and live in London, and London is a sort of home from home for the Indian rich. When India gets really hot, about now in the summer, Delhi is incredibly hot, and the Indian rich decamp to London to go to Wimbledon and sort of hang out in the nice parts of the British capital, including a number of tycoons who've sort of gone there as fugitives, including this guy Vijay Mallya. So what happened, and this is the core story of the billionaire Raj, is you had this extraordinary wealth creation at the top, the crony capitalism that came with it. And then there was, as you say, a backlash, an anti-corruption backlash, which was partly political, so marches on the streets and Narendra Modi being elected, but it was also a business collapse. So you had this boom and bust cycle where a lot of these billionaires invested a whole bunch of money. Then the things they invested in kind of came unstuck, partly because the corruption in a lot of it was revealed. And so there's been this kind of, even though India's rate of growth has been very high, its industrial economy, the building of steel mills and ports and that kind of thing, has kind of crunched to a halt, and it's left a lot of debt in the economy. And Mallya has become a kind of poster child for that, because his airline went bust spectacularly because he mismanaged it, and the government are trying to get him to repay what he owes, and he has disappeared off to London. And so he has become this kind of emblem for the irresponsibility of the boligarch class.
Is it quaint to talk about social inequality in India, or is there a genuine concern about where things are going?
No, I don't think it's quaint at all. I mean, I think one of the things that, as your listeners think about India, that I think we all, I have a self-interest in this because I've just written a book about it, but I think it's fair to say, I think we all need to think about India and where it's going much more than we do. We think a lot about China, we think quite a lot about the Middle East, but in the end, we all have a stake in India's future. It's the world's largest democracy. It's a sort of secular, multicultural society at the moment of a sort. And if India can become a success, a middle-income parliamentary democracy, relatively liberal, in which Hindus and Muslims and Christians and Jains and Sikhs can all sort of broadly live in harmony, then that will be a great thing for humanity. I don't want to be too sort of over-egg this too much, but at a time in which China is sliding back into becoming a sort of neo-Leninist autocracy, Russia, we all know about Russia, right? And so the way India is going, the way its society is being shaped at this very critical stage of early development is very important. And, you think the same was true in America in the Gilded Age. This was the moment in which many of the critical institutions of American public life were made in that period, in the latter half of the 19th century, both industrially, the building of canals and railways, but also all sorts of things, sort of the building of the library system, the beginning of the creation of the middle class, a reformation in urban politics. So it's a very, very important moment in India's history. And the way in which India goes, does it become a prosperous, market-friendly, liberal society, or does it go in another direction? Now, that is really one of the big questions of this century, one that should concern us all.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and I'm speaking with James Crabtree about his new book, The Billionaire Raj, A Journey Through India's New Gilded Age. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. Arun Venugopal, I'm talking to James Crabtree about his new book, The Billionaire Raj. So James, tell me about the resistance movement. To what extent is there one in India?
Well, so we were talking just before the break about corruption. And prior to the 2014 election, there was a huge popular movement against the endemic corruption that had swept through India. There were a number of figures who led this. Latterly, that is not quite so prominent anymore. Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, who is a very controversial figure, some accuse him of being involved in brutal ethnic violence earlier in his career, but he has been relatively successful at stamping out the very worst of the corruption scandals that dogged India 10 years ago. And so now, if you're talking about resistance or sort of the way liberal-minded people think of India, then they're much more worried about what you would call Hindu nationalism. So Narendra Modi is a Hindu nationalist. He believes, or his supporters believe, that as opposed to being a secular multicultural democracy, that India is primarily a nation for Hindus. And that expresses itself in various rather grisly ways, many of which involve being nasty to Muslims in particular. And so that is the thing that most kind of vexes people. The other thing, I suppose, is sexual violence, which is not something which I deal with in my book, but that is obviously something that has captured global attention about India, that it is a place where There are unfortunately large numbers of very grim cases of sexual violence against women, and that is also a situation which has brought people into the streets in recent years in protest against the fact that in large parts of India it's not a terribly safe place for women.
Let's talk about one of the characters in your book. Her name is Meera Sanyal. Who is she?
So Meera Sanyal used to be a banker. She was the head of Royal Bank of Scotland, which is a British bank. So she was a capitalist, and she lived in South Mumbai. And she ran for Parliament a couple of times, latterly in 2014, on an anti-corruption platform for a new political party, which is called the Aam Aadmi Party. Now, the word Aam Aadmi literally means mango man. But what that means is basically the man on the street, the man who would stand on a street corner and sell you a mango. And the Aam Aadmi Party, in that period before the last election, in which you had a large number of really eye-watering scandals in India, when it appeared as if this mixture of billionaires and corrupt politicians were... Well, it didn't actually appear. This is exactly what they were doing. They were sort of siphoning off hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And the Aam Aadmi Party was an anti-corruption party which emerged to try and tap into that. And so Meera Sanyal was one of the figures I interviewed her in the book who stood... And she was unsuccessful, as were most of the politicians, a little bit like in America, in the Congress here. It's quite difficult in India. It's a British-style parliamentary system, so you have to win in your constituency. You have to get a majority to win, and so it's quite difficult for minor parties to emerge. And so although there was a great wellspring of support for anti-corruption movements, actually a lot of the candidates, like Meera Sanyal, didn't end up winning. And that was an election in which Narendra Modi, the current prime minister, did very well.
Given the very high levels of poverty, despite what you mentioned earlier about, basic poverty being, I guess, lessened in recent years, why do you think there is so little support for, I guess, more radical economic and political reforms?
Well, that's an interesting and very complicated question. There is. If you mean pro-poor policies, then it's very, very difficult for an Indian political party to be the kind of party of the rich. The majority of voters in India are either very, very poor, or they're farmers, or some combination of both. And so it's difficult for any political party has to be mindful of this mass rural vote that dominates in the country. You then also have complications. I mean, it would take hours and hours and hours to talk about the way in which the caste system plays into politics, but at a very simplified level, there's a phrase people talk about in India, which is that you don't cast your vote, you vote your caste. And so caste politics in large parts of the country is very important in terms of how people decide to vote. If you're talking about a far-left politics, part of the reason why that's not very good is that the far left has proved to be largely disastrous whenever it's been given power, particularly in states like West Bengal, which was run by communists for a long time and was a complete basket case. There are a couple of other states where the far left have done better. But in the end, India's politics traditionally has been fairly socialist in its orientation, and certainly even Narendra Modi's party, which is sort of centre-right in some ways, would never do anything that was strongly against the interests of farmers and the poor, because they would get punished at the ballot box. One of the remarkable things about Indian democracy, and this is really interesting, is as opposed to the West, where the rich and the middle classes tend to vote and the poor tend not to, it's the other way around in India. The rich often don't vote at all. Some of the richest parts of the country in Mumbai and Delhi have the lowest voting rates. But the poor in the areas which are, in slums vote. Almost everybody votes. It's a sort of ritual thing. So it's completely the opposite of what we have come to expect here, where, sort of NPR listeners see it as their duty to vote. But maybe if you're, less fortunate, then you don't, because you don't see what's in it, what's the system that has it in for you. In India, it's totally the opposite, which is one of the most startling things when you first go there.
We're discussing Meera Sanyal and the Aam Aadmi Party, and I guess its limitations in helping, I guess, push through reforms. What is, I guess, the relationship between the Modi government and the Baligarchy, as you refer to it?
So under the preceding government, which is run by a party called the Congress, which is the party that has run India most of the time since independence, so India became independent from Britain in 1947. Before that, it was run under colonial rule, and the Congress were the party of national liberation, and they, for better or worse, ran the country for almost all of its independent history, off and on. Modi is from a different party. Latterly under the Congress, that was when all the problems occurred, these big scandals, and so the government was seen to be deeply in bed with the tycoon class. Modi has kept them a little bit at a distance. It's not like Russia, where you've seen the government, basically either throw them out of the country or bump them off. You know, Indian politics isn't quite as crude as Russian politics. But he's kept a distance because he realizes that the oligarchs are very unpopular, and he desperately does not want to be seen as being in the pocket of big business. And he has put a stop to some of the biggest corruption scandals. So whatever else you think about him, and he's a divisive figure, you know, that's fairly positive. The problem in India is the funding of political parties. So here in America, many people think the way that politics is funded is sort of deeply corrupt, but at least you know who's giving money to whom. So even though lots of rich people give money to political parties, at least we basically know it's all disclosed, and we kind of know there's far too much money in politics, but we know who's giving to whom. The problem in India is the political system is comparably expensive. One estimate suggested that the last election cost in some $5 billion, which is not far off what an American presidential campaign would cost. And almost all of that comes under the table. The officially declared component of that is tiny. The amount that an Indian candidate is meant to be able to spend, I actually don't have the figures off the top of my head, but it's very tiny. And the amount they actually spend is, you know, millions, often tens of millions of dollars. And almost all of that comes under the table from the only people who have the money to give in that volume, and that's the big businessman. And so that's kind of the original sin of Indian politics, is it's a very expensive political system in which all of the funding comes illegally under the table. And until you fix that in some way, either you go the American route and you make it transparent, or you go the European route and you have some system of public funding of political parties, it's very difficult to have a kind of clean political system, because the money's got to come from somewhere.
When you're discussing this residence, Antilia, Mukesh Ambani's fabulous $1 billion, purportedly $1 billion home, you quote, I think it was Ratan Tata, an industrialist, who says, this is the stuff of which revolutions are made. Do you think there's any truth in that, in terms of, do these displays of, you know, fabulous wealth really, I guess, rile the masses?
I think to some degree, yes. So Ratan Tata is, I often sort of describe fairly simply that, you know, in India, as in many places in the business scene, you have sort of good guys and bad guys. You have what I sometimes call the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And Ratan Tata is definitely one of the Beatles. He runs a company called Tata, which is a quite famous global company, but it's basically ethical, admirable, a bit boring. But he's seen as the patriarch of Indian business, very honest man. And yes, so he sort of rather regretted in the end saying this, because it became very controversial, but he was sort of caught in an interview saying, this is the stuff that revolutions are made of. And I think there is a sense in India that resentment against the super wealthy is going to grow if India continues on its current path. Thomas Piketty, the author of Capital, the French economist, who has been one of the leading voices in sounding the warning bell about the rise of global inequality, have sort of said this of India, that the risk is, unless you begin to take action democratically to lessen extreme inequality, and what does that mean? It means the rich have to pay taxes at a very minimum, and the poor get sort of lifted up through systems of social support, which is what happened in most East Asian economies. Unless that happens democratically, then it will begin to happen in other means. Now, we don't see that at the moment. I wouldn't say that at present in India that a sort of angry public reaction against the super rich is the sort of primary leitmotif of politics. I would say the thing that vexes people at the moment is this issue of Hindu nationalism and the kind of decline of India's secular politics. That's the sort of thing that's most front of mind. But actually, that may be a mistake. I mean, in the end, for India's development from a poor country to a middle-income country to a rich country, then the economics is almost more important, I think. And so keeping an eye on, are you managing to get corruption under control? Are you doing something to create a kind of reasonable level of social equality in which the poor are looked after in particular? Then that is a primary concern.
There was a time, not maybe 10, 12 years ago, when there was this real sense of global sort of euphoria about India and its future, you know, I guess perpetuated people like Thomas Friedman, and the emergence of these companies, say like Tata himself, who was buying, was a Jaguar. Mm-hmm. And there was this, I guess, moment of real excitement about the possibilities for India to, I guess, exert itself on the global stage, as well as to also lift up hundreds of millions of relatively poor people. Where do things stand now in terms of that perception of India and its possibilities?
Well, I mean, India is a curiosity. So my book, The Billionaire Raj, focuses mostly on the bad guys. They were the ones I was interested in. I mean, they seem to me the most intriguing figure. But India's economy, again, is not like Russia. It does have high-quality blue-chip companies that are globally competitive, like its IT software exporters, or a company like Tata, which is a huge conglomerate, kind of ridiculous, does hundreds of things from making tea to, as you say, Jaguar Land Rover cars, steel, all sorts of things. But, you know, basically an ethical company, broadly speaking, quite admirable. And so, although I focus exclusively in the book on the sort of darker side of the Indian economy, there's plenty of things to be optimistic about in India. If you go to a city like Bangalore in the south of India, it's a high-tech hub. It's getting lots of money from Silicon Valley. The same would be true in a city like Hyderabad. You know, and India in general, I think there's a lot to be optimistic about. You just have to look at the Indian diaspora here in the United States, which is extraordinarily successful. Hinduism is America's richest religion. You know, Hindus on average are richer than Jews. They're richer than Mormons. Hindus here are enormously successful in medicine, in technology. I mean, if you go to Silicon Valley, Indian started software companies, immigrant Indian started software companies are overwhelmingly the largest of any group of immigrant-founded software companies. And so I'm not kind of taking a cultural reductionist point of view in saying there's something inherent about India, but nonetheless, you know, the Indian diaspora is very successful when put in an environment in which it can succeed. And so I look at that and I look at the brighter spots of the Indian economy, and you know, in the long run, I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about India. But if it wants to succeed and it wants to move from being a, you know, sort of poor, lower middle-income country to being a proper middle-income country to being a rich country by the middle of this century, then it has to fix these problems that I talk about in The Billionaire Raj, the fact that it has an awful lot of inequality that has come through its super rich, that it hasn't yet really lanced the boil of corruption, and it doesn't have an industrial model that doesn't go through these kind of boom and bust swings as you saw over the last 10, 20 years.
The comparison to America's Gilded Age, I guess it's interesting that America went through this progressive era and now we're revisiting this social inequality of our own, isn't it? I guess it's ironic. Do you have hope that India can actually get past its own problems with inequality?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if you were to have looked at America in 1880, as I said, you know, you would have said this is a irretrievably corrupt country. And then, you know, 20, 30 years later, things looked a lot better. So with wise public policy, I think there's always room for optimism.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Arun Venugopal, and I've been speaking with James Crabtree about his new book, The Billionaire Raj, A Journey Through India's New Gilded Age.